Today we want to talk about evaluating decision support systems projects. Earlier we looked at doing feasibility studies and decision-oriented design, and we do evaluation at the beginning of a project. We do it during project execution, and then we should also do decision support project evaluation once it's been implemented. So we do multiple evaluations. How much evaluation we do depends on how much money we're spending on the project, how many people are impacted by it. We roll the size of the project together, whether it's people or dollar amounts, and the complexity, and we often call that scope. So how broad the impact is of the system. And then we also want to take into account the clarity of the objectives, how much ambiguity there is, and that structure variable that we've talked about before, plus scope, tells us something about the risk of the project. Riskier projects should have more evaluation. So if we've got a high scope project that's a cost a lot, very complex, impacts a lot of different players in the organization, and there's some problems with the structure of the project, we want to do a lot of evaluation. Who does the evaluation and who should determine how much is done? Well, both the project sponsor and the manager of the project. The project sponsor is going to be held accountable to other people in the organization, so they need to have something to say about it. And clearly the project managers benefit from having periodic evaluations to help in controlling the project execution. If you look at the slide number 3, it shows that project evaluation is ongoing. It's not continuous, it's periodic or episodic. We want to schedule reasonably frequent evaluations if it's a high-risk project. At the initial idea stage, we look at whether or not we think this is going to have benefits for the organization. We do a formal feasibility analysis, and that's where we most often do a cost-benefit trade-off. At the scheduled milestones, and that's more with the system's development life cycle, if we're doing rapid prototyping, we do it at the end of each iteration in developing the prototype. Prior to full-scale implementation, so we do a final check of the application. We may do pilot testing, and part of pilot testing is that formal evaluation prior to full-scale implementation. And then we should do follow-up evaluation. That's most often neglected. At the end of 60 days or 6 months or a year or 2 years, we should think about doing some evaluation of the decision support system. The chapter goes over a number of tools. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on those today because you can read about them. Cost-benefit analysis, that's the traditional tool that we use. The financial analysts expect us to be able to look at the net present value and the payback period for the application. To do that, we have to look at both direct and indirect costs and direct and indirect benefits, and then we have to be able to discount them using the cost of capital for the organization to see if we're going to have net benefits. The most common ratio that we'd look at is the cost-benefit ratio, and we expect that to be greater than 1. Then cost-effectiveness, that's where we look at only one side of the equation. Most commonly, we look at the cost side. We assume that multiple projects all give us approximately the same benefits, so that we look at the comparable costs to deliver those benefits for each project. Scoring approach, it's more, we're not working with dollar amounts, we're trying to assign ratings or scores to the projects. Incremental value, and I want to talk about that when we come to that slide in a little more detail, but we're looking at incremental value analysis as pretty much rapid prototyping on a budget. Then the research and development options approach, and that's perhaps the hardest to understand, but we're trying to spend a little bit of money now to keep possible the opportunity to build a full-scale VIA decision support system in a specific area at some later time. So we spend a little bit to keep the possibility alive in the organization. And then finally, the qualitative benefit scenario approach. Cost-benefit analysis receives the most treatment because that's the one that you have to make sure you understand if you're going to do a financial justification. We do need to dollarize all of our costs and as much as possible our benefits. That is, we want to assign dollar amounts so that we can add things up. So we want to use the same metric for both benefits and costs, and that's dollars. We need to explicitly state our assumptions. When we do an analysis to spend future amounts of money on a project, we want to disregard what we've already spent. So we're not trying to justify new expenditures based on how much we've already spent. And we call those prior expenditures sunk costs. When we look into the future for a project and we look at costs and benefits, we make estimates. And those are good faith estimates based on how much we know about the real costs and the real benefits associated with the project. Costs and benefits accumulate over time, so if we want to look at the real value of those benefits today, we have to discount those dollar amounts to the present. And if we want to make a comparable analysis, if we're going to incur some of the costs in the future, we have to discount those back to the present also. That's called the net present value approach, and that's fundamental to a financial analysis of costs and benefits. And then we can do sensitivity analysis. Sensitivity analysis usually relates to the discount that we're going to use when we discount. So is it going to be 7% or 5%? But we may also do sensitivity analysis on our cost estimates or on our benefit estimates. If you look at slide 6, we go into a little bit more detail on the process. One thing we have to keep in mind when we look at both costs and benefits is the whole life cycle cost. So it's not just the development costs, it's also the operation costs, and it's not just the immediate benefits, but it's the longer term benefits. So we want to look at direct and indirect costs and benefits, tangible and intangible. Tangible means that we can actually see them and measure them. Intangible means that they are harder to describe and make concrete, and measurement becomes more difficult. So direct costs and direct benefits stem from the project, from the DSS project. Indirect are ancillary. They're impacted by having the project, but they are harder to identify. Some cost factors are listed in slide 7. The ones that we often forget are the process change costs and the incremental infrastructure costs. Process change is, with decision support, we may change how we make the decision, and that may involve some costs that we need to take into account. And then incremental infrastructure means, what do we have to add to our infrastructure to get the decision support system to work? So if we need a lot of bandwidth for the network, that would be looked at as an incremental infrastructure cost to upgrade our network capabilities so that we can move large files across the network quickly or use video or whatever else we're using in the decision support application. Benefit factors. The hardest one to measure is improved accuracy in decision making. How do we value that? How do we assign a dollar amount to it? Now, a benefit like improved access to data is also hard to quantify in terms of dollars. Consistency is hard to quantify. Faster access to decision support information or decision support capabilities is difficult. Oftentimes, the easiest is cost savings, but many decision support systems don't have any cost savings associated with them. All the benefits are intangible. like faster access or improved access, improved accuracy, better consistency in our data. So putting dollar amounts on the benefits is always a difficult part of the cost-benefit analysis, which is why we tend to focus on cost-effectiveness analysis more than we do cost-benefit analysis, if we can get away with making the assumption that the benefits from alternative ways to do the project will be essentially the same. Slide 9 goes over a little bit about cost-effectiveness analysis, and you should make sure you read that and understand that what we're trying to do is say that the best alternative in most cases is going to be the one with the lower cost once we've determined that the benefits are approximately the same. Scoring approach means that we're going to use a rating system, and in many cases we have multiple raters evaluate each alternative approach to the project, and it may be evaluation on benefit cost factors or other factors like the reliability of the vendor or the experience of the development team, more intangible evaluation factors. And then we calculate a weighted score for each alternative based on how important we think the factors are. Slide 11 lists some other scoring factors, technical viability, business justification, that we add on in addition to cost and benefit factors. Incremental value analysis, I mentioned it briefly. What we're basically trying to do is figure out, here are the benefits that we think we'll get from the project. They are worth $100,000 to us. So we're willing to spend $100,000 on the project. That becomes the budget for the project. Once we have spent $100,000, we don't want to spend more on that project, and we hope we've achieved all of the benefits. If we have achieved all the benefits and we've only spent $70,000, we stop spending money. So we need to continuously monitor how much we're spending and what benefits we're getting from the application. That's where rapid prototyping comes in. We develop an iteration of the decision support system. We see how much we spent on that iteration. Then we look at the benefits that we've gotten, how much of the project is completed, and we decide if we're going to add features or if we're going to stop. Incremental value analysis only works if we think that we can stop the project either without having spent all of the budget or before we get all of the benefits. So we need to prioritize the parts of the project and do them in that priority order. And hopefully we get all of our priorities completed before we run out of money to spend on the project. So you've got a finite amount of resources to spend to deliver those benefits. We try to prioritize the implementation of the project, and our goal is to bring the project in under budget. So we iterate and we measure. Any questions about that? So it's an incremental approach to project development. R&D options approach. The idea here is that we want to establish a research and development budget, and then we take some projects that we would like to do in the decision support area. We don't have the money to fully fund them now, but we spend some money today on training or software or other kinds of activities or purchases that will give us the opportunity to begin the project at some point in the future. Let me give you an example from real estate. Say that there's a beautiful lot that you'd like to buy to build a house on. Okay, you can all imagine that, your dream house. You're going to build it out in the country, and there's a beautiful lot out there. The person who owns the lot today says, if you give me $1,000 today, I will let you buy that lot from me anytime in the next year for $10,000. If at some point in the next year you have the $10,000 and decide it's a good idea to buy that lot, then you go ahead and you proceed and you buy the lot. But if at the end of 1 year you don't have the $10,000 or you don't think it's such a great idea anymore, then you forfeit your $1,000 on the option and you walk away. The landowner's gotten their $1,000, so they held the property for you. You had the option to commence with purchase and you chose not to. Now you could extend that option by maybe giving the landowner a little more money, but that's only if you think a year from now, at some point in the future, you're going to want to still buy that property. That's the idea of an option. We pay a little money now so that we can engage in the project or make the purchase later. The most common things that we do would be to have somebody trained in the software, or we send them to a conference, or we have them go out and visit companies that have implemented this kind of a system before, or we buy the package and we have one person who reads the documentation and learns how to use it. Those are all investments that we make today to give us the option to execute the full project later. Now the qualitative scenario approach says what we do is write up a word description of the organization with the decision support system implemented. So we would write up how we would be using the decision support system and how it would impact our decision processes, how it would impact outcomes in the organization. We write a word story. That's what a scenario is, a word story. So the scenario tells us how the organization is going to be different once the decision support system's been put in place and how managers will be using it. It makes it more concrete. Once we develop this scenario, we can use it to discuss the benefits with managers and we can check for the consistency and plausibility. Technical people can say, well, this seems too future-oriented. We don't really have the technology in place to do that today. You know, you're unrealistic in terms of thinking that if we build it, that we'll realize those scenario benefits anytime in the next year or two. We can discuss the risks a little more concretely from the big scope, from the lack of specificity about objectives, and we can estimate upper and lower bounds on costs, and we can look at a development schedule that would take us from where we are right now to where the scenario would be realized. So the scenario helps make things more concrete. All right. There are four general project evaluation tests that are discussed: the economic test, the operational test, the schedule test, and the technical test. The economic test is our cost effectiveness or cost benefit test. The operational test looks at how well this solution will address the problem with the decision process that we're trying to correct. The schedule test looks at how reasonable it is to implement this decision support system in the time span that we've planned, and then the technical test looks at whether or not we have the expertise and the resources to do that. Technical risk is one of the most difficult things to really get a hold of when we're doing innovative decision support projects. We need to look at the stability of the technology, the team skills, the scope and novelty of the project, how clear our project definition is, whether we've got the success factors in place, especially a project champion, and whether or not our team that's going to implement it, either outsourced or within-house, has had prior success with similar projects, or the team has had the training and feel optimistic that they can meet our schedule. The last part of this chapter deals with international and cultural issues and then briefly touches on some ethical issues with decision support systems. The main thing I want to tell you is that because decision support systems are increasingly distributed in global organizations, we need to be much more sensitive to international and cultural issues than at any time in the past. So we need to look at who the potential users are going to be. We need to look at where our data is and who's going to control it. We need to look at issues in terms of the infrastructure to get access to web-based DSS, time zone differences across our users, whether there are technology standards we need to be aware of, and if there are regulations that may impact who can use it, what data we can store, and who we can share data with. I'm not going to go over the cultural issues, but you can read about them. And those of you who were born in the United States and are native English speakers, you can be very glad that you learned English as a child, because English is the language of decision support. English is the language of multinational companies. English is what we're going to have in the user interface, even if we try to localize. So when we build systems, we need to make sure that they are accessible to non-native English speakers as well as native English speakers. So you run into problems with expression, with word choice, with translation when we build interfaces that are going to be used by non-native speakers. So you don't want to get cavalier. You want to think about who your target users are, what their language skills are, what their native language was, and what they expect in the user interface. The chapter talks about some data source issues. A major one in data-driven DSS deals with accounting and currency issues. There are different standards for accounting in different countries, and we need to be sensitive to how reporting occurs because we use that accounting data in our decision support system. And then we also have to realize that people buy from us and we sell to them in different currencies, and so there's always some currency risk when we're in a global marketplace, and we have to figure out how we want to handle that currency translation into our decision support system. Do we look at what currency those sales are in now, or do we adjust everything based on current values of the currency? So right now, we've got bank accounts in England that are in pounds, in France that are in euros, in Japan that are in yen, and in the United States that are in dollars. For decision support purposes, do we want to basically say in today's dollars, that is with the exchange rate for all three of those currencies, this is what our situation looks like? Or do we want to keep those amounts in the currency that they are held in right now? And that becomes a major issue for us when we display data, because currencies fluctuate. So our sales may have been the equivalent of $100 US in the last quarter, or $100,000, or $100 million. But that doesn't mean if we held it in dollars or we held it in euros, that that's what those sales are still worth to us today. So we have accounting conventions for that, but that doesn't mean that they work equally well for decision support. We need to know what we want to get out of the decision support information. And oftentimes today, we want to give managers the opportunity to look at what actual sales were in the currency that they occurred in, and then be able to quickly change them to the currency that they're held in today at current exchange rates. So we need to have fairly sophisticated information related to sales and expenses in our decision support systems and global organizations. Well, localization, we don't have that completely figured out, but it's a lot easier with the web today. Sometimes we can do it with automatic translation. Any of you who've used the Google language tools know that we can translate web pages with machine translation. It works better sometimes than others. At DSS resources, you'll see some of the material is translated into various languages. A human translation is always better. So if you're going to do help documents or user screens, I recommend that you get them translated by somebody who is a native speaker rather than relying completely on machine translation, at least for your home pages, for your major displays. And then you allow people to switch between two or three languages depending on where you're doing business. The most difficult time is to work with Mandarin or with Japanese, where the characters are different. We have to have provision in our displays for those character sets. As much as you can, emphasize graphics. Try to use universal symbols. Believe it or not, in most parts of the world, a red stop sign is pretty pretty universally recognized as meaning stop. And the so a lot of our cultural symbols do translate across cultures, but you need to make sure of it when you design the user interface. So the stoplight metaphor works pretty well across cultures. So red stoplight meaning stop, green stoplight meaning go, yellow meaning caution. Caution is the hardest one. Yellow isn't always used there. I mean, I've been in places where they don't have a caution. They've got red and green, and that's about it. But some of those metaphors work pretty well across cultures. Well, that's about it. The lecture notes don't talk about the ethical issues. I did write a column recently on ethical issues and decision support, and I strongly encourage you to think about that. I'll show you where that's located, and then we wanted to finish up today, so we've got a little shorter lecture. But in Volume 9, Number 5 of DSS News, I had a column called What Are Ethical Issues Associated with Building and Using Decision Support Systems? And it goes over a fairly long list that expands on the material that's in Chapter 12. So I give you a number of scenarios. Scenario 1, a builder of an executive information business intelligence system chooses not to build a key metric because the data is hard to capture and display. Eventually that metric, for example, the weight of a prototype airplane, becomes a critical flaw that leads to a major cost overrun. So where's the ethical lapse? Is it in the builder who chooses to ignore it? Is it in the sponsor who doesn't demand it? Is anybody at fault when you leave out a key metric? You'd think somebody should be at fault. And there are 9 different scenarios here. If we had more time, we'd talk about each of those. It certainly doesn't cover all of the ethical issues in building and using decision support systems. The first 5 tend to focus more on building, and then we've got some user scenarios. So scenario 9, a manager extracts data from a decision support database and transfers the data in an email to a home computer. The home computer is subsequently stolen. Hopefully we'd have a security policy that would tell that person they shouldn't do things like that and that they wouldn't, but people do. And we need to decide whether we want to build things onto our system to keep that ethical lapse from occurring. So column goes over ethical issues from a builder perspective and from a user perspective, and those of you who've been looking at my columns that I've been writing, you should see how they fit into the next version of the book. I've tried to take topics that I wanted to expand on in the next topic, and so I've done that in the column, and hopefully by next spring when I teach this class again, we'll see a new version of the DSS book. It's probably about 50% longer. So you guys got the short version. Okay. All right. That's about it for today.